All right, so we're going deep today. A real deep dive into some fascinating stuff.
Yeah, should be fun.
You bet. You've brought us some really thought-provoking material from Dr. Robert Peterson's Church and Last Things.
It's a rich text, lots to unpack.
Absolutely. And for this deep dive, we're zeroing in on a concept that's, well, it's foundational to everything, really.
I'd agree with that. Fundamental.
The beginnings of the people of God. And specifically in the Old Testament. Because, you know, it's easy to just assume this idea kind of, I don't know, pops up in the New Testament.
Right, like it's a new invention.
Yeah, exactly. But our mission, if you will, for this deep dive is to trace the roots. All the way back.
Way back. Genesis. And those crucial covenants. And hopefully along the way we'll unearth some surprising connections for you.
I love it. I love it. So let's start at the absolute beginning. Adam and Eve. Garden Eden. Seems pretty straightforward, right? I mean, we all know the story.
We think we do.
But you're suggesting that this is actually the very first picture of God's people.
That's exactly right. When you connect this to the bigger picture, what you see in Genesis 1.1 is the cosmic stage being set. God creating everything.
Right. Ex nihilo.
And then Genesis 2 zooms in. On the local stage, if you will.
The garden.
The Garden of Eden, precisely. And that's where God places those first humans, Adam and Eve.
Okay, but their creation, it wasn't just like all the other creatures, was it?
No, it wasn't. And that's crucial for you to grasp here, this unique way Adam and Eve were created.
So walk us through it.
Genesis 2.7 tells us, very specifically, that God formed Adam from the dust of the ground and then breathed life into him.
Okay.
Now, other creatures also received the breath of life. We see that elsewhere in Genesis.
Right.
But Adam's creation involves this, it's this personal, intimate act from God. It's
very hands-on.
It is. And then you have Eve, who's formed uniquely from Adam's rib. Genesis 2.2123. This highlights their special status, this connection to God unlike any other.
And then there's this whole idea of being made in Christ's image. I mean, we've all heard that phrase countless times. But when we're considering Adam and Eve as the first of God's people, what's the real takeaway for us there?
It raises a huge question about what it means to be human, really. This being created in God's image, like Genesis 1.27 says, it means that they were made to reflect God in specific ways.
Give us some examples.
Peterson mentions knowledge. Colossians 3.0 Nabo talks about that. And righteousness. Ephesians 4.24. But it also includes this capacity for relationship.
Okay.
With God, obviously, but also with each other and with all of creation.
They were given dominion.
Exactly. Dominion over the created world. Genesis 1.26. So the takeaway for you is this. Their identity, their worth, it wasn't self-made. It was God-given from the very start.
They had this direct connection, unbroken, with God in this perfect setting.
Perfect setting. But we know it didn't last.
That's right. An enemy was already there, lurking.
Right from the beginning. And even in this ideal state, an adversary was present. Genesis doesn't get into all the details of his origins, but Peterson points to other scriptures.
Yeah.
Like Revelation 12.9 and 20.2 that identify him as Satan, the devil.
Right. But we have to remember, God created everything good.
Yeah.
Genesis 1.31 makes that clear. So this enemy, this Satan, he was originally a good angel.
He chose to rebel.
So if we think about it, this enemy, he had a clear strategy, right? He wasn't just passively hanging around.
No, not at all. And what's fascinating to consider is how Peterson pulls these different scriptural threads together to show Satan's role as an adversary.
Consistent role.
Throughout the whole story.
Think about Job. Where Satan tests God's servant, or Matthew 4, where he tempts Jesus, even Luke 22, where he influences Judas.
Right, right.
Paul warns about his tactics in 2 Corinthians 11, and Ephesians 6 talks about his schemes against believers. And, of course, ultimately, Revelation 20 depicts his final defeat. So, yeah, cross-scripture, the picture is consistent. Absolutely. So, back in the garden, his tactic was to directly attack what God had said.
Directly. He challenged and then completely denied God's command. That whole thing about not eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, Genesis 2.17.
Right.
And Peterson quotes Kidner here. Kidner has this really sharp insight. He says, the first doctrine to be denied, the very first, was judgment.
Whoa, okay.
God said they would die.
You shall surely die.
And the serpent counters, you will not certainly die.
It's pretty fundamental, this denial of judgment right from the start. Mm-hmm. And Peterson reminds us that Jesus... He affirmed this doctrine.
Strongly. Adam and Eve's choice. to believe the serpent over God.
Huge consequences.
It's huge.
Which leads us to, I guess, the rebellion and its results.
And to that powerful way of looking at the biblical story. Not so much Old versus New Testament.
But pre-fall versus post-fall. So let's talk about that. What happened? I mean, the fall, it wasn't just some, like, minor slip-up.
It wasn't just a mistake. No, it fundamentally changed everything. For humanity. Mm-hmm. Their relationship with God, with creation, everything. Mm-hmm. Peterson emphasizes the immediate spiritual death.
What do you mean by that?
Well, think about Genesis 3. They're hiding from God.
Right.
The blame game starts. Mm-hmm. Verses 11 to 13.
They're ashamed.
They are. But they didn't experience physical death right away. That came later.
Okay, so these consequences.
Yeah.
They weren't contained to just Adam and Eve, were they? I mean, it spread outward.
Yes. Affected all of creation. You see Eve's pain in childbirth.
Right.
Adam's struggle with the ground. All in Genesis 3:16-19.
It's all connected.
It is. And then there's that pivotal curse on the serpent.
Genesis 3:15.
That's the one. It foreshadows this whole story of redemption, this conflict between the serpent's offspring and the woman's offspring.
The proto-evangelium.
Exactly. Culminating in that ultimate clash between Satan and Jesus.
The striking of Christ's heel and the crushing of Satan's head. Powerful imagery. But we also have to grapple with the reality that this fallen state, it's not just something that happened to them. It's something every human since has inherited.
Core theological concept right there.
Huge implications.
Humanity inherited both guilt and a corrupted nature from Adam's sin. Peterson points to Romans 5:15-19 to explain that. We're all, in a sense, represented by Adam.
It's like we were there.
In a way, we were, and our nature is now inclined towards sin.
We see this played out over and over again in the Old Testament.
We do. Vivid examples. The tragic story of Cain and Abel.
Genesis.
Genesis 4:1-15. The widespread evil before the flood. Genesis 6. The pride at Babel. Genesis 11:1-9. And, of course, the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah. Genesis 18 and 19.
So humanity is in this predicament.
Yes.
Separated from God. This inherited tendency towards sin. It's a bleak picture if there's no divine intervention.
It is. It really underscores the absolute necessity of God's grace for salvation.
Hebrews 9:15.
And Peterson really wants to drive home Paul's point in Romans 5.
Yeah.
The far-reaching impact of Adam's sin, death, condemnation, death reigning, condemnation for everyone, many being made sinners. The initiative for rescue, it had to come from God.
And that initiative, as our source explains, is ultimately revealed in the Trinity's work in the New Testament.
The Father choosing, the Son redeeming, the Spirit applying salvation. But it all starts with this deep understanding of the fall. Okay, but even after this cataclysmic event, God doesn't abandon humanity.
That's right. And a key way he continues to relate to us, to his people.
Covenants.
Covenants. They're like these signposts throughout the biblical story, aren't they?
They are. What's fascinating for you to note is that these covenants, they become this defining characteristic of God's relationship with his people.
I like that. Defining characteristic.
Throughout the whole narrative.
Yeah.
As Peterson explains it, a covenant is a formal relationship initiated by God himself.
It's not a contract.
No. It involves promises that he makes. And expectations he has for his people.
Okay, so for this deep dive, we're going to focus on three main covenants. The Noahic, the Abrahamic, and the Mosaic.
Perfect. Let's start with the Noahic covenant. Set the scene for us. What was happening with that time?
Well, you have this backdrop of widespread sin, corruption, before and after the flood.
Genesis 6.
Genesis 6:5-7. It says God even regretted making humankind.
He was grieved.
He was. And decided to wipe them out.
But
Genesis 6:9 highlights that Noah, he found favor in God's eyes, and God chose to make a covenant with him to preserve human life through the ark.
Genesis 6:1-2. And we also see this echoed in the New Testament in 1 Peter 3:2.
Exactly. So the flood, it was this massive act of judgment against sin. But that covenant with Noah, it's fundamentally about God's promise of preservation.
It's like a reset button in a way.
In a way, yes. After the floodwaters receded, God commands Noah and his family to repopulate the earth.
To be fruitful and multiply.
That's right. And in Genesis 8:21-2, God makes this really significant promise. He will never again curse the ground because of mankind. And he won't strike down every living creature again. He promises the continuation of the natural cycles.
Seed time and harvest. Cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, as long as the earth endures.
Precisely.
So if we connect this back to the idea of the people of God, what's the significance of this Noahic covenant?
Peterson quotes Gordon Wenham here.
Okay.
Wenham says the flood shows God's hatred of sin. and it serves as a warning of future judgment. But the Noahic covenant, it offers reassurance that God will maintain the natural order
despite ongoing sin,
and he'll preserve a remnant of the righteous. Walty adds another perspective.
Okay.
That God guarantees the continuation of humanity until the end of history, and that he will providentially care for the earth until that final judgment. You see this in 1 Peter 3.20-21 and 2 Peter 2.5-12.
So this covenant, it's about God's commitment to sustaining life despite rebellion.
Yes. His overall plan. It's a universal covenant applying to all of humanity.
That makes sense. Okay, let's move on to the Abrahamic covenant. And Peterson makes a point of saying that this is the first covenant specifically focused on salvation.
And that's huge.
Absolutely huge. He stresses that the Abrahamic covenant, it serves as the basis for the Mosaic covenant.
And the very foundation for the new covenant.
Which ultimately fulfills and surpasses it.
The story starts with the Lord appearing to Abram in Ur.
Joshua 24.2-3.
And God gives him this life-altering command to leave his home and journey to this promised land, Genesis 12.1.
And the promises that God makes to Abraham at this time, they're extraordinary, to say the least.
Stunning. That's the word. Genesis 12.2-3 lays it all out. God will make Abraham into a great nation, bless him, make his name great so that he will be a blessing.
And then there's that crucial part.
Through him, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Later, in Genesis 15.1, God himself says that he is Abraham's shield and his very great reward.
That's a promise.
It is. So for you, this really highlights the immense scope of God's promises right from the start.
Okay, so then we see this formal agreement being made in Canaan.
Genesis 15, God establishes this formal covenant. Promises Abraham a son and descendants as numerous as the stars.
As numerous as the stars in the sky.
Verse 6 is pivotal here.
And he believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness.
Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. Peterson reminds us that the New Testament quotes this verse multiple times. Romans 4.3, Galatians 3.6, James 2.23.
Justification by faith.
Exactly. Illustrating that core principle. Now, the way this covenant is ratified, it's really remarkable.
Is that whole thing with the animals?
Right. It follows an ancient custom. For formalizing royal land grants, Abraham prepares the animals, cuts them in half, Genesis 15.9 to 10. And then a deep sleep comes over him.
It's like a trance.
It is. And then, in this symbolic act, only God passes between the animals, represented by a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch. Genesis 15:17. This signifies a monergistic covenant.
Meaning what exactly?
It means that God alone is undertaking and guaranteeing the terms.
It's all on him.
It is. Peterson quotes Waltke explaining this. He says it's like God's invoking a curse upon himself if he breaks the covenant.
Wow.
Draws parallels with ancient Near Eastern texts and references Jeremiah 34.18. It emphasizes God's absolute commitment.
Incredible.
It is. Now, while the ratification is monergistic, Peterson also points out that the covenant is bilateral.
You mean both sides have a part?
In the sense that it calls for Abraham's devotion. Trust.
He has to respond.
Exactly. And the boundaries of the promised land, they're laid out in detail, Genesis 15:18-21, and they reach their fullest extent during Solomon's reign. You see that in 1 Kings 5.1.
Okay, so we've got this covenant being made, these promises, this land, and then the covenant is reaffirmed later, right?
Yeah.
Genesis 17.
Yes. God appears to Abraham. He's 99 years old at this point. Changes his name from Abram to Abraham.
Genesis 17.5.
And commands him to live in his presence. Be blameless. Genesis 17.1.
Okay.
The core elements of the covenant, they're restated in Genesis 17.7-8, emphasizing its everlasting. For Abraham and his descendants, and the gift of the land of Canaan as an everlasting possession.
And that's when circumcision comes in.
Right. Circumcision is established as the sign, the seal of this covenant.
Genesis 17.11. Romans 4.11 talks about this too.
A requirement for all male descendants. And this shift from Abraham's passive role in Genesis 15 to this active command in Genesis 17.
That's pretty significant.
It is. So to sum up this Abrahamic covenant, it's just loaded with promises, blessing, the formation of a great nation, becoming a source of blessing for all families. God as Abraham's protector and reward. God himself swearing to uphold the covenant.
And God establishing this everlasting relationship with Abraham and his offspring.
That's a cornerstone.
It is.
Okay, let's move on to the Mosaic covenant. Now, Peterson mentions a tendency, I think it's a common one, to kind of downplay this covenant.
I think you're right.
Because of New Testament statements about the new covenant being superior. Right. And there are a lot of passages that talk about that. Galatians 3:15-29, 2 Corinthians 3:7-13, Hebrews 7:1-19, Hebrews 8:1-13.
A lot of folks just think, well, the old covenant's obsolete now.
But Peterson makes a really important point. He says that underestimating the Mosaic covenant, it actually diminishes our understanding of what the new covenant offers.
You can't fully appreciate the new without understanding the old.
Precisely. So this Mosaic covenant, it's also called the Old Covenant, or the law. It comes into focus in Exodus 19:24. And Peterson points out that often when the Bible uses that word, the law, it's specifically referencing the Ten Commandments.
The Big Ten.
Gentry and Wellam, they see the Ten Commandments as the very heart of the covenant established at Sinai.
Okay. So how should we be understanding this Mosaic covenant then?
Peterson encourages us to consider how the Israelites back then would viewed it. Not looking back from the perspective of the New Testament, but from their own time and place.
Makes sense.
He outlines five key ways that God gifted his people through this covenant. First, it was rooted in God's redemptive grace. Exodus 20:2, it states, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery.
They were redeemed.
They were. And Douglas Stewart explains that this act of liberation, it was the very basis of Yahweh's claim on Israel. The law wasn't just a set of rules, it was a gracious gift from their Redeemer.
It flowed out of his love for them.
It did. And you see that reflected in Psalm 119, this deep love for God and his instructions.
Okay, so the law was a gift. What was the second way it was a gift?
Second, the Mosaic covenant was particular. God chose Israel alone to be his treasured people among all the nations.
Exodus 7:6, 10:15, 14:2.
And this selection was purely by his grace. Exodus 7:6-8. Third, it defined the identity of God's people. Moses reminds them in Exodus 19:4 of their redemption.
I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself.
That's right. And then God's call to covenant faithfulness in Exodus 19:5-6 to be his treasured possession, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation.
It shaped their understanding of who they were in relation to God.
Chris Wright, he interprets this as Israel's unique status, God's treasured possession, and their mission to be this priestly and holy community, representing God to the nations, although they often fell short of this calling.
It's a high calling.
It is. Okay, the fourth way the Mosaic covenant was a gift.
Lay it on us.
It showcased God's attributes. The God of glory revealed himself in power and majesty. His justice and holiness were evident.
Exodus 20:1, Hebrews 12:1-19 talks about that too.
The prohibition against idolatry, Exodus 20:4-5. It revealed God's jealous love, his demand for exclusive devotion, Exodus 20:5-6. Now, Stewart clarifies something important here. When God talks about punishing future generations for the same sins, it highlights his determination to judge persistent disobedience, not innocent descendants for their ancestors' actions.
That's a good clarification.
Yeah.
So what's the fifth and final way?
Fifth, it formed the core of scriptural ethics. WASI says that the Ten Commandments are the most important expression of God's will.
For human conduct.
Right. And Paul House, he emphasizes the lasting significance of this ethical framework. He shows how Moses in Deuteronomy 5:6-21, the prophets like Jeremiah in Jeremiah 7:1-15, Jesus in his teachings in Matthew 5-7, and the apostles like Peter in 1 Peter 2:9, they all drew upon and expounded this covenant morality.
It's woven throughout.
It is.
Okay, so when viewed in its original context, this Mosaic covenant was an incredible, multifaceted gift.
From God to his people.
But the New Testament still emphasizes the New Covenant's superiority. Why is that?
Well, Peterson looks at it from the New Testament perspective. Paul contrasts the Mosaic and the New Covenants in 2 Corinthians 3:6-9. He describes the old as a letter that kills, bringing with it death and condemnation, while the new is the ministry of the Spirit, bringing life and righteousness.
It's a stark contrast.
It is. The law, once glorious, now has a diminished glory compared to the surpassing glory of the new covenant.
2 Corinthians 3:0.
That's it. Yeah. And Jeremiah 31:32 prophesied that the new covenant would be different from the one God made with Israel in Egypt, a covenant they broke.
So is Peterson saying that the Mosaic covenant was flawed?
No, he's careful to point out that the failure wasn't with the covenant itself. It was with the people.
Their inability to uphold it perfectly.
Exactly. Despite their initial agreement. Exodus 19:7-8, 24:3, and their understanding of the blessings and curses. Deuteronomy 28:30-20.
They still messed up.
They did, repeatedly. Peterson highlights their fundamental misunderstanding of the Mosaic covenant in relation to the Abrahamic covenant,
which was grounded in grace and faith.
Yes. Galatians 3:10-18. It's the same error the Judaizers made in the New Testament,
trying to earn their salvation.
Exactly. They focused on meticulously keeping the external requirements of the law instead of responding in thankful obedience to God's grace and relying on his mercy.
Exodus 20:2-6.
The prophets called this their uncircumcised hearts. Deuteronomy 10:1-30:6, Jeremiah 4:4. We'll have to explore the Davidic and New Covenants in our next deep dive to see how God addresses this ultimate need.
So we've covered a lot of ground here. We've gone from a perfect garden to the establishment of covenants to the giving of the law. It's a lot to take in. So help us connect the dots. What does it all mean for us?
If we pull all these pieces together, the picture of God's plan becomes clearer. This concept of the people of God in the Old Testament, it's not a sudden thing. It's rooted in creation itself.
With Adam and Eve.
Then the fall happens. Sin and separation enter the picture. But even then, God takes the initiative to establish relationships through covenants.
Covenants are key.
They are. The Noahic covenant, it promises preservation for humanity. The Abrahamic covenant, it's the turning point. It initiates God's specific plan of salvation.
Blessing a chosen people.
And the Mosaic Covenant, it was a gift, but it ultimately exposed humanity's inability to fulfill their obligations, highlighting the need for something more.
It's like the Old Testament is laying the groundwork, showcasing God's faithfulness, but also humanity's struggles, setting the stage for the New Testament.
Exactly, those themes. Creation, the fall, God's covenantal love, the tension between grace and human failure. It's all crucial for understanding the big picture.
The grand narrative that leads to Christ.
Yes.
This has been an incredibly thought-provoking deep dive. I mean, really, getting this deeper understanding of the Old Testament, it changes your perspective. So for you, our listener, we want to leave you with something to ponder. How might this understanding of God's covenants in the Old Testament reshape how you view God's relationship with humanity? What does it truly mean to be part of God's people today?
What aspects of these beginnings and covenants resonate with you? What questions do they raise about this ongoing story of God and humanity?
Thanks for joining us. Until next time.
Take care.